Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden, and we are happy tonight to return to discuss landlord-tenant law, this being the summer installment for 2025. Last time we endeavored to discuss landlord-tenant law changes had gone into effect since the first of the year. But what's changed since then? And I'll give you a clue. There has been some changes since then. San Francisco itself is always a hotbed of activity. Are there any local changes afoot of which we should be aware? It appears there's been quite a bit of construction amidst a slowing economy. Has this eased the upward pressure on rental costs? As always, we want you, our most important guest, to join in the conversation, so give us a call. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Bear in mind, our attorney guests are here to educate and inform. They can't provide specific legal advice for specific cases that they haven't seen yet. But they're all here to help. They can give you guidance as you try to sort out a path, knowing a bit more about the legal principles. Returning tonight to our landlord-tenant broadcast are three of the top landlord-tenant attorneys in this part of the state. For some 20 years, San Francisco landlord-tenant attorney Jessica Chalik represents clients in rent board actions, mediations, and in court for landlord-tenant issues. Jessica launched her practice to specialize in San Francisco residential evictions, vacancy agreements, and rent board petitions for tenants, landlords, master tenants, and subtenants. Also from San Francisco, attorney Salvatore Timpano is considered one of the top attorneys in the Bay Area to practice in the area of landlord-tenant law, representing both landlords and tenants in the area of eviction. And joining us tonight from San Mateo is attorney David Finkelstein, a graduate of NYU School of Law. David is admitted to practice in the states of California and New York, beginning his career as a staff attorney in California for the National Housing Law Project at what was then Bolt Hall School of Law. And for the last 40 years or more, David's been representing clients in real estate and landlord-tenant matters. David was published having written an article on the issue of protection for renters during COVID-19 crisis, published in the Apartment Owners News magazine. Without further ado, David, Jessica, Sal, welcome back to Your Legal Rights.
Good to be here.
Yes, nice to be here.
We have a caller on the line already. This is surprising, but let me turn it to Harriet from Santa Cruz. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, my question is, I put my daughter in a house that I had bought with the agreement she would pay rent. Then COVID came and I let it slide for 3 years. Now we're into year five and I want to evict her. Is there a problem with that? I own the house. She's my daughter. I don't live there with her.
Have you ever collected rent?
For 1.5 months at the beginning. She got in there in 2019.
And nothing since then?
Correct.
Did you get any compensation through the COVID landlord landlord-tenant programs?
I did. In 2020, I got compensation following our initial agreement, which was 2020. She was to pay $3,600 a month. And I did get that compensation from the state for 1 year.
Well, Dave, Jessica, I think she can serve a 3-day notice for rent up to 1 year back, 12 months back.
Right. Yes.
The question is whether she could serve a 30-day notice if this is, if she would be considered a tenancy at will or a tenant at will. Also, even if she's not, isn't this house exempt from the statewide rent control? And she could also give a 60-day notice.
Well, let me ask you a question on that, Harriet. Is it a freestanding, standalone house, no other units?
It's a townhouse.
When was it built?
1972, I think. But okay, it's a townhouse in a community. It's in good condition.
Well, then, so the condition, I mean, the condition will matter, but not for this first step, but it'll matter as far as affirmative defenses. It needs to be in good condition, you know, with, well, anyway, that's another issue. But with respect to what Dave just said, David, single family homes could be exempted from the Tenant Protection Act, but you would have had to send her a letter that said that before she moved in. So if you didn't do that, then it's part of the rent control under the state scheme. Which means you may have to, you may not be able to serve the 30-day. Notice, it's under the rent control part of it, not necessarily the whole Tenant Protection Act.
And as far as an eviction for, you know, for non-payment of rent goes, those can only go back for one calendar year, so 12 months for an eviction. But if all you want is to collect money and let her still live there, there's potentially a different lawsuit called a breach of contract action for just the money part. Eviction is about possession of the property.
Harriet, is your main goal to get the house back or to try to get some of the money she owes?
Well,
she wants the house back, I think.
I want the house back. And I didn't know if she could drag me through court if she was a bad girl for me helping her out. I didn't know what her rights were. Since she's my daughter.
What county did you say?
Is in Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz.
Well, practically speaking, I mean, she could serve a 3-day notice for 1 year's rent. And then if the daughter defends by saying, you agreed I could live there for free, then
I never did.
She's saying she's a tenant at will, and you could do a 30-day notice on her and get her out. So,
okay. I mean, there is a Santa Cruz County lawyer referral service, and you should probably give them a call.
Okay.
And David, that tenancy at will, would that be similar to like a licensee?
No, you still have to go through the, there's a statute for tenants at will. It just has to be someone who's been living there, but hasn't paid any rent.
Forcible detainer?
No, because she was living there with consent, but no rent. It's called tenancy at will. I can't think of this. It's, I think it's somewhere in the 900s of the civil code, and it can be terminated on a 30-day notice. But I would start with the, like Jessica and Sal said, with a 3-day notice going back 1 year. And if she defends and says, you agree I was staying for free, then serve a 30-day notice. And I don't see how, then she can't say, oh, but I'm a tenant paying the rent, when she answered the unlawful detainer under penalty of perjury saying she was there for free.
I agree.
So she's got a dilemma, your daughter. One way or another, she's going to have to get out.
Okay. This is the, unlawful detainers, evictions are not something that you should go without at least consulting an attorney and getting some advice. So I suggest you call the Santa Cruz County Lawyer Referral Service.
And that's run by the Santa Cruz County Bar Association. The number to reach them is 831. 425.
Okay.
4755.
Great. Thank you.
You could also go online and do it and make the appointment request online at lawyerreferralsantacruz.org.
Okay.
Very best wishes to you.
Best of luck to you. You're one of the good ones. It's a sad one.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that I've had, I have two similar cases. One with dealing with, they're both dealing with daughters. And one of them is in LA and the other one is up here in Daly City. And neither one was the daughter paying anything. And they just refused to get out. Interesting cases.
My own opinion in history in dealing with, you know, family disputes is that it does not help any family situations. If there's already bad blood, it's only going to make it worse. If it was a rocky relationship, it's, you know, going to be hard to get through. But, you know, if it's something that needs to be done, the house either needs to. And if the relationship
was straight up, they probably wouldn't need to be calling in and asking these questions. So
fair enough. Yeah,
in one of my cases in the Daly City one, the father owns the house and he divorced the mother of the daughter who's in there. And he's with another woman, and that's caused a real breach and whatever. We've actually offered her to stay and pay rent, but she hasn't responded. In the other one, they're claiming the grandmother wanted her to stay there for free or whatever. So, as I said, they're unusual cases. They're not your regular non-payment of rent case.
David, before we went on the air, we were all talking about some changes in the unlawful tenant law. You alluded to it a little bit when we were talking with Harriet, but what's changed? I mean, we were talking about the notice you have to give on a 3-day notice and the like.
Yes, but it's an LA second appellate district, which I guess technically is not binding in because we're in the first district, but it's certainly some indication of what's happening in the LA area and what the requirements. And in that case, the court held that the actual 3-day notice to pay rent or quit not only has to say you have 3 days after you're served, but it actually has to say the specific date when you're being served, which means to me, and I'm trying to, you know, give you a roadmap, it means to me that you have to leave a blank line after that phrase in the 3-day notice and have the server fill in the date when he or she is actually serving it so that the tenant has notice of the specific date right in the 3-day notice. Mm-hmm. Now, I've changed my notices to so provide, but I don't know if anybody else in the Bay Area is doing it or not. Maybe Jessica or Sal could speak to that.
I haven't made any changes, and hopefully I don't get punished for it. You know, because my notices say effective on the date that it's served upon you. So it's not technically in compliance. The other thing I might do is just put in the date of service, because when I send it out for service, that's the day it gets served. That's just the arrangement I have with my process servers. And because they don't have to be personally served, they can be posted and mailed on that date. You know,
that sounds like a reasonable solution. Yes, good idea. Right.
Just to eliminate the process servers from having to write in a date. Sorry, Jessica, you were saying?
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, a lot of my clients are lower income and we save the cost of a process server on the notice and they do it themselves. And I give them instructions to attach the proof of service with the dates filled in, just not signed.
And when you say they do it themselves, do they get a friend to do it for them so that the actual plaintiff is not the one serving it? That's how you do it?
It depends on the person. Sometimes, you know, Sometimes they want to handle it themselves, and that's fine with me. I don't have a problem with that.
I stopped letting clients do it because I didn't want any credibility issues about service of the notice. So I wanted Fair to enough. Have someone else. And of course, the best is to have a licensed process server because, you know, that, right. then you've got that, that would be the gold standard here. Thing.
I recommend in almost all cases that we use a process server to avoid being at a trial and not having the landlord believe that he actually served it.
Right.
Yeah, but I think the next best thing would be a friend of the landlord, you know, a friend sure. who's not interested in the outcome. I mean, they're a friend, so there's already that issue, but at least that would remove the landlord's credibility from the issue.
Right.
But you haven't had a problem with it, Jessica.
No, right? No, but I'll be honest, the bulk of my cases settle. I've had more bench trials than jury trials, and the bulk of my cases settle. So,
well, the best cases settle. If they're not prepared right, those are the ones that are going to go to trial, you know. But when they're prepared, it's like, well, let's just, you know, let's not risk it. So,
right.
Yeah, I know a lot of our stuff is unanswered.
The bulk of my cases settle too. And usually what happens is we offer the tenant, you know, like 30 days rent free if they agree to move out. And the bulk of them agree to do that. And I tried to tell my landlord, you're not really losing anything because 95% of these judgments that you would get are not collectible anyway. If they can't afford to pay the rent,
right,
and they, you know, they don't have a job, your chances of collection are very poor.
Yeah.
There is one caveat here that I want to throw out there, though, and that is when you were all saying about whether it binds us or not, you know, it was in LA court, so it won't really bother us. For people that are acting as their own attorneys or are not invoking an attorney, tread cautiously there. There are a California Supreme Court decision, one that goes back to 1962, which says that all lower courts are bound by the courts of appeal, even if it's from another jurisdiction. So it would take a court at a higher level than this court in LA before it would free the court you're appearing in front of from being absolutely bound. Let me turn it to Julie from Oakland. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, hey, thanks. So my understanding is that in Oakland or in Alameda County, there's a statute or a law that says that for a new owner trying to evict tenants to move into a place they just bought, a single family home, that they cannot do it during the school year if there's a teacher or a student in the house. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. That's patterned on San Francisco, who's had that for decades.
Is that the county or the city of Oakland? Is it Alameda County?
I believe it's the county.
Yeah.
Alameda County. Okay, and then
has that been adopted by the various cities in Alameda County towards a countywide ordinance, or is it only unincorporated area at this time? If you know.
I haven't dealt with all the different counties, but my understanding is it's countywide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm sorry, Julie, you were asking a follow-up when I jumped in.
Yeah, been extended to family home daycare if the tenant is running a licensed daycare in the single family house?
In addition to being an educator or having kids in school?
Well, say there were no kids in school or they weren't a teacher outside of that, but they're like a early educator. They're, you know, in the daycare, preschool, in the home.
Hmm. Well, daycare and preschool, I'm not sure if that qualifies as a educator because they work through the summer. They don't have summers off. Am I right about that? Yeah, they don't have the reason for that rule regarding educators is that why would you need to evict them during the school year when you're going to disrupt everything? Just wait till summer. I mean, there's still summer school, but there's got to be a time to evict. So summer is it. But with a daycare, daycares run all year round. I don't know that they would qualify, although I don't know the answer.
Do you think that it would be something that a judge would want to look at if it were contested?
The judge is going to look at everything. If you're the landlord and you're thinking to do the eviction, you know, it's summertime now. So if you do it now, you might avoid having to even deal with the issue.
It's end of summer. And if they're doing an owner move in, that's going to be, 2 months notice, right? 60 days? That's going to take us into the school year.
Yeah, because the date of eviction is what's going to matter, not the date that the notice is served.
Correct.
Right.
It seems to me that if it's applied to a daycare that's year round, to apply it in that fashion is basically saying that the daycare and the people that live in the house just stop paying your rent. Don't do anything. You don't have to because you're absolutely exempt from eviction. So there has to be some give somewhere.
I don't think you're exempt for non-payment of rent. We're just talking about voluntary or, you know, where the landlord's moving in or otherwise is terminating without cause, right?
Yeah, without fault.
Yeah.
So without fault.
That would be a no-fault eviction, and that's the one that's restricted. Non-payment of rent, you can evict for that as soon as it occurs.
Even if it is the school year, if it's something that's the tenant's fault.
Right. Okay. So another question, somewhat related. I think I also understand that in Oakland, when landlords are screening a tenant application to move in, they're not able to see if the tenant has had an eviction. Is that right?
I believe that is correct. I don't believe they're allowed to search the records or have a process server search the records of the courthouse.
Going forward, are evictions going to be traceable?
If an eviction case settles and does not go to trial or other judgment for possession, then it is masked by state law and has been for most of my practice, I think.
Yes, I find almost all of my settlements are masked, but can't the landlord ask for a referral from prior landlord? I think they could still do that.
Yeah, you can still ask for references.
Yeah. That's what I would do. Ask for references. And if you don't get any references for the last 5 years, that sort of would clue you in that there's a problem.
Right. But so if the eviction does go to trial, those records are fair game for landlords?
Yes, if there is a judgment entered in an eviction case, whether it be a judgment for the tenant or a judgment for the landlord, then yes, those should be available at the county courthouse.
Okay, thank you.
All righty, thank you for joining us. And let me turn it to Eve from Oakland. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, this is Eve from Oakland. I am calling in because I've been a tenant rights counselor for a really long time, and I was pretty shocked to hear a whole radio show of giving free advice to attorneys on this station, and it seems like a bad move during fundraising season. I also just wanted to give any listeners...
Well, we're not giving advice to attorneys. We're giving advice to whoever's listening and wants to call in and overwhelmingly.
I just wanted to give, you know, some words of solace to any tenants in Oakland or the Bay Area, maybe the tenants that Julie's trying to evict, that a lot of the advice being given on the show is incorrect. And so if there's, that's something, and I just wanted to share that, and join your tenants union if you haven't yet, fight the landlord clock.
Well, thank you for joining us on your legal rights. And we do try to keep it balanced, but the advice we give tends to be based on who's calling in rather than pre-formatting it. All of our attorneys that are on tonight will represent both tenants and landlords. So it's really a question of who's calling in and asking and answering the question. It's not a question of us taking a political position, not a question of taking a legal position on one side or the other. And I have three of the best landlord-tenant attorneys in the region on the air with us right now. So feel free to call us with your questions. We appreciate your perspective, but the law is what the law is.
It's sort of like what some political person is saying to, if you don't like the change in the news, fire the person who's telling it to you.
That's pretty much the message. If you don't like the message, shoot the messenger. Well, we're just here giving legal advice to whoever cares to call.
Historically, a lot of tenants have called in.
Mostly tenants over the years have called in on this program, and we've referred people out to attorneys rather than giving calls, you know, rather than giving advice to other attorneys. So, pledge drive or not, this is what we do. And speaking of what we do, we have some very interesting shows coming up, and I hope that you'll be here to join us. Next week, given that Texas Republicans want to hand the president 5 new House seats, Governor Newsom seeks to counter that with a vote for redistricting in California. What's this all about? Next week, we'll explain what gerrymandering is and why some advocate this as a perfectly valid response, while others would say it's a bad thing across the board, whichever party may benefit. Please be sure to join us next week on Your Legal Rights, Wednesday at 6, where, as always, we take your calls and answer your questions. But we have another show coming up in 2 weeks. Attorney Roberta Kaplan and author E. Jean Carroll have a lot to say about the law, about standing up to a past and future president, even if he says she's not my type. That's in 2 weeks right here, 6 o'clock, Your Legal Rights. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. And we'll be back right after this.
Hi, I'm Victor Tense, the senior producer of Cross Currents, and I'm also a product of KALW's Audio Academy. And everything we do here, our journalism and our training programs, have just taken a hit because the U.S. Senate has stripped away all federal funding for public media. Now's the time to stand with KALW and support the storytelling that supports our communities. Go to kalw.org and click donate right now. Thank you.
And thank you for that message, Victor. And yes, we are asking you on this one-day fundraising to support local public radio at 800-525-9917 or at kalw.org, where that Stand with KLW button is right there waiting for you. And we so appreciate you for stepping up for Your Legal Rights, a program that is exclusive to local public radio, KALW, a program that you do not hear anywhere else but this station, KALW. So if you appreciate what Jeff Hayden does along with his guests that come on the show, and sometimes he might have a guest host. And we ask of you to support local public radio at 800-525-9917 or at kalw.org. And also, support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can dial 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. We now turn it back to Your Legal Rights with host Jeff Hayden.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We're talking about the status of the landlord-tenant relationship, whether tenants are still protected from eviction, or landlords have to pay their tenants to move. What are new limits to security deposits? How is it retroactive? We're covering this matter, all related questions on landlord-tenant. You're welcome to join us. We have three of the best tonight. Tonight's guests, Jessica Chalik, Sal Timpano, and David Finkelstein, are among the best landlord-tenant attorneys in the region. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking landlord-tenant law. You don't have to jump into where we are in the conversation. And we're the only people in the Bay Area that are doing this. There's no other radio station which has for some 40 years now been here to give legal advice or legal guidance, teaching legal principles. We're the only folks in town that do it. Nobody else would give this airtime to a program such as this one. It's only to KALW. You can show them some love for keeping the and help them keep the doors open for folks like us. You can call 800-525-9917, or you could pledge online at kalw.org. But we're the only game that does this in this area. If you need legal advice, you want to talk about the landlord or tenant that you're dealing with, we're the ones to help you out. Call us. So what is the status of service animals? I understand. Oh, we do have a call. Let me turn it to Grace from San Francisco. You're on the air on your legal rights.
Oh, thank you. I have a question about Section 8 HUD properties. There is a tenant down the street from where I live. It's a big problem. And it turns out that the property has an illegal in-law apartment, which the city knows about and is taken care of. But it turns out that the landlord, as I understand it, did not notify HUD. And I have been thinking about doing that, but my concern is that if I notify HUD, SF Housing, which is no longer, it's now another organization, that somehow I would be responsible for interfering with that contract. And so would there be any repercussions to me if I notify a government agency that rents out, that's responsible for renting out apartments, houses, notifying them that the landlord has a major violation against one of their properties and it was not disclosed to them?
Yeah, it's interesting.
What liability or exposure is there for the whistleblower? Grace, do you own your home or do you rent also?
I own my home.
Okay.
Well, that's interesting. I would say if there's an illegal contract, then you can't frustrate it because it's already void, you know, by its illegality. So an illegal unit would be based on some kind of illegal contract, whether it be written or oral. And I don't see that you could frustrate that contract because it doesn't even exist. It can't be enforced.
You know, Section 8 folks are supposed to have an annual inspection and renewal. So anything that inhabitability issues would have to come up at that point.
But they don't know that the unit, let's call it an in-law unit, is illegal because they check for electricity, plumbing, locks, doors, stuff like that, but not for an illegal in-law apartment. So, yes, they may have inspected it, but they didn't go to the next level of inspection in terms of checking out the permit status at DBI. That's beyond their scope of work.
So is it your understanding that Section 8 is paying the landlord for use of that illegal space or for use of the other part of the house?
It's my understanding that Section 8 is giving a voucher for the entire house.
Okay, for the entire house and unaware of the... So it's a two-unit building, really. It's got the main house and then the illegal unit. Yeah. So the landlord's collecting rent,
really,
presumably on the illegal unit.
Okay. Yes.
And the Section 8 tenant is in the main part of the house, like that?
True, but also in the illegal unit section.
You know, was it the landlord that divided it or the tenant that divided it?
It's the landlord divided it.
Okay.
Many years ago.
I may have a little bit different point of view. I have no problem with a caller filing a complaint with the city of San Francisco. I'm assuming it's San Francisco. And that's privileged, even if you're wrong or whatever complaint. But I'm not sure whether it's privileged to file with HUD, because HUD doesn't do the permitting or whatever. And I don't know. I would be careful that it could still be interference with the economic advantage of that a landlord, even if it's not interference with contract. But
because the landlord did have a legal obligation.
If I were advising you, I'd tell you to file a complaint with the city that there's illegal renting going on there, because that's absolutely privileged.
Well,
has the unit already been reported to the city?
The city has mandated that the illegal unit needs to be removed, so everybody is aware of that. Okay. The issue at hand is that the landlord is supposed to notify HUD if there's ever a violation against the property, and they did not do that.
David, what about sending a copy of the notice of violation to HUD? What do you have an opinion on that?
Anonymously. I think that's better than calling and verbally objecting. If you send him a copy of the notice,
that notice, I think, is I treat it as public information, you know, under the Sunshine Act. So then sending a copy of it, that doesn't mean that HUD is going to do anything. They might not do what you might think they would do, but I don't see a problem with sending them a document that's public record.
That's a good idea. I appreciate that. It's been lovely. Thank you.
Grace, thank you for joining us on your legal rights. So what happens in an event like this one? Suppose that Grace was a renter and it was another renter in the building that was dividing up their space and bringing in too many people and the like. Because that's really what her nuisance is, that they're subdivided, they're bringing in too many people. If she was renting from the same source, what protection does she have if the landlord wasn't reacting to it, was allowing them in violation of their lease and presumably her lease?
Well, if Grace had been another tenant in the same building, where a tenant in a unit was, subdividing their unit, so to say, renting out the living room and, floor space on the kitchen floor or whatever. The rent board, in San Francisco, there is a maximum amount of tenants who can be in a unit. It's usually two per bedroom and, maybe like one on the couch or something like that. But so it would, but children don't always count because they get to stay with their parents.
Don't most leases also, though, have a clause that says for this particular unit, you're limited to this many adults and this many children?
Depends on the...
Go ahead, Jessica.
It depends on the particular lease. The San Francisco Apartment Association lease certainly says that, but but other leases that I've seen that people have, you know, quote, found online. Right. Yeah, I found ones that say Connecticut at the bottom and or copyright 1987. So, yeah, make sure your leases are up to date.
Yeah, I would say that the tenant would be protected by under the retaliatory eviction statute and common law for against retaliatory eviction for complaining to the city about the rental or subdivision that was illegal. But they're only protected for 180 days. So it's not forever that they're protected.
Yeah. And then they get a rebuttable presumption during that 180 days as well.
Yeah.
Right? That they've been selected for eviction because of the report they made.
But if the landlord can prove that there is some other reason, like they stopped paying rent or something like that, then that yes. rebuttable presumption is rebutted and goes away.
Yeah. I didn't understand from the prior caller if she thought, she seemed to have a lot of information on that property. I didn't understand if she thought that Section 8 was paying for two units or, you know, I didn't understand, that, but you know, because Section 8 wouldn't necessarily know that one unit is not permitted. They, you know, I mean, unless it's so obvious, I don't know that they would even know. But that would be a clear violation of their rules.
Also, there could be other reasons that, you know, that's why I was a little uncomfortable about that caller, because who are these Section 8 people? Are they minorities or disabled people? Or does she think that they're lowering the value of her adjacent property? That's why I felt a little uncomfortable about saying okay, because I didn't know the motivation. Why was she so concerned that there was an extra person living in the other unit?
Ah. I see, David. Yeah, that would be, like...
if she had some improper motivation.
Yes.
Right, yeah. Even if that wasn't the case, you could still draw a lawsuit, and then you've got to defend.
Yeah. So,
you know,
people can sue. I tell my clients all the time, you know, people can sue anybody for anything. It's just, you know, then you have to figure it out in court. I could sue any one of you for punching me in the face, even though we're nowhere near each other. Right. And then I just cause you aggravation for the next however much time it gets to until you prove that I didn't.
That's right. Yeah.
And then the answer to that is further litigation. You know, you can sue for malicious, you could do this, you could do that. Instead of going on vacation. So it's, you know, yeah, treading lightly is definitely, you know, I assume the caller is still listening. You know, treading lightly is probably, you know, she might need assistance from counsel to go further on that just to explore all this stuff. But I still think providing the public record would be the safest. But still, David, your point's still like, well, why'd you do that? You know what? Why'd you provide the public record? Still, you know, just because it's a public record, it was not necessarily going to shield her from, you know, litigation. So, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's a risk in everything you do, pretty much. Most of the time, the risk is negligible. You know, very small, but sometimes they come out from behind things and get you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've had cases where Section 8 just didn't do what my client thought they would do, you know. And so it's not, you know, you can't just anticipate what's going to happen, because it might not be that way at all.
Right. I mean, I've had all different reactions in a similar, situations in, for example, Redwood City, where there is a lot of overcrowding And there's a lot of people, and many of them are Hispanic families living in garages. And I've had all kinds of reactions. And lately, the reaction is completely different than it was 5 years ago, when the landlord would be given a notice 30 days to evict everybody. But today, it's more like, well, come in and we'll advise you on how to make your garage an ADU, and we'll give you, I mean, we might even give you some financial assistance and do. So the whole aspect of it has changed from, so I don't know how it is in San Francisco, if it's similar to that or not.
I haven't heard of garages being, convertible to ADUs, but
that's right.
Yeah, I mean, they're right up against that, because they're pushing to, you know, illegal units now. You have to apply for ADU before you can demolish it. You know, mm-hmm. you've got to do that, and it's kind of expensive. So they may be also reducing the costs on that, but I haven't had right. one that went that far. But you know, the ADUs have become really popular, and even in San Francisco, the city is pushing for illegal units to be legalized rather than right. demolished. And that's right. been a while now. That's probably
oh yeah, absolutely. And they're also encouraging folks who have, you know, large yards and that sort of thing to add additional housing in that large yard, whether it be an ADU or a small cottage or something like that.
Yeah, I guess it's an opportunity for property owners to get additional income, and they're not forced to do it, so seems like a win-win.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked a lot about the California Tenant Protection Act. What's the status of that right now? Is it due to sunset, or has it been made permanent, or where are we with that?
Well, it's permanent. The 2019 TPA.
Yeah,
I haven't heard anything about it not being. You know, it expires and then can renew.
Right.
I haven't heard that it hasn't.
I think they keep making it stronger. They added a provision for treble damages for violation about a year or so ago, and they've also tightened up on. Used to be able to give the tenant a notice of that it were doing improvements, and you didn't have to specify, and it'll take more than 60 days to finish it, so you have to leave. But now that's been completely tightened up, so you have to get a permit first, and you have to have a signed contract to do the improvements, and you have to specify what they are. So it's really difficult to use that anymore to evict. At least that's what I've been finding.
Right. Yes, I've heard that Sacramento is adding additional parts to tighten it up. It's beginning to sound more and more like San Francisco or Oakland, mm-hmm. and yeah. their rent control.
Yeah, that's what it seems like to me, and I don't have any belief that it's going away. Most counties in San Francisco don't even need it, just the big ones that are overcrowded. Other, other counties that aren't overcrowded, they don't even, they don't even brush up against it. It's just the crowded counties that are, utilizing that Tenant Protection Act. So I don't see it going away at all.
No, it's here to stay.
A few years ago, we were talking about when COVID ends, when some of those restrictions get rolled back, there must be a flood of eviction litigation that's been backed up. And there was never a flood, but are the numbers anywhere near where they were before?
I haven't noticed any. We didn't have any backup of evictions. We did during COVID. There was a lot going on, but then when the moratorium was lifted, I didn't have a flood of evictions.
Neither did I.
Nor I either, on the peninsula.
I haven't seen a flood of evictions either. But going back to, you know, I think we've got sort of a backwards way of dealing with the need for essentially for more housing. And what I'd like to see in a lot of cities on the peninsula is the height restrictions loosened, which we're beginning to see a little bit, but we should be more of it because it's a sort of self-evident if you're limited to three stories of apartments as opposed to eight stories of apartments. There's a lot of missed opportunities to expand the rental stock, which I don't see why there's not more emphasis on expanding the rental stock than on restricting the rental income.
Right. And, you know, I know there's a lot of people in San Francisco, there's starting to be some development, you know, on the western side of Van Ness and out perhaps in like Pacific Heights and the Marina and Cow Hollow and that area. And people are very much objecting to tall buildings. But I think that six or eight stories is not really out of line. I mean, I can understand an objection to something like, you know, 20 or 30 stories easy, but, you know, in more single family housing neighborhoods or you know, two or three flats type area. But yeah, but there's some people who are really objecting. And I think that six stories, eight stories is probably within the realm and should be seriously considered so that there is more stock available.
Right. But until recently, like on the peninsula, most cities had pretty much a three-story limit. I think many of them are changing, especially if it's along the rail corridor of Caltrain or BART or along the bus lines, that they are allowing at least six stories.
Right. You know, because historically, before the you know, before everybody had cars after World War II in the 1950s and stuff, there were a lot of rail lines and a lot of bus lines. And actually, I just read an article this morning from AC Transit, the you know, Alameda and Contra Costa County bus service. They're putting in, they're doing something called a rail line, and they are putting in new bus lines to state parks that haven't had bus lines for, you know, the entire time I've lived in the Bay Area, since 1994 or before. And so, you know, so the people from all areas can go to the parks, not just one or two, but, you know, six or eight or 10, however many are in these, you know, in Oakland.
Also, on the peninsula, which is where I basically live and practice, also the parking requirements for apartments and condos have been greatly liberalized if you're within walking distance of a rail or a bus line.
Now, how so, David? How have they been liberalized?
My understanding is along the Caltrain and it depends on the city, along the Caltrain in BART, they have been liberalized to like one car per unit or even less, and especially less if it's senior housing. And this is something very recent. So, and I think that's the right thing to do. If you want to encourage more housing and more affordable housing.
So they're reducing parking.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, yes. They're reducing parking. Okay. But and they're substituting with, or at least building near the public transportation or yes. like that.
Right. Right. You know, because
what they're trying to do is encourage more housing rather than making sure there's more parking per unit.
Right. And there are, you know, and there are certain groups of people that have fewer cars, you know, whether it be seniors or, you know, low income folks or whatever it is. And if they're living close to good transit, they're not, you know, they're more likely to use it. And it, honestly, it's more cost effective. I looked into getting a car when I moved up here and quite frankly, I've been very happy with my transit.
Oh, no doubt about it. A car is expensive. You know, you'll save a lot of money by using public transportation if you can do it. You know, you got to live in the right place. And then, you know, you're kind of limited to where they can take you. But it's way much, much cheaper. Cost effective to,
you know, use that. Finish your thought.
No, I'm done.
Okay, one quick question. We've got about a minute left. And in the past, it seems that our rental housing picture has been really out of control. Has that softened any? Has the balance of power shifted a little bit to where maybe it's more in balance between landlord and tenant?
I don't know, quite frankly. I do know that rents are still quite high in San Francisco and in Oakland. And also in Berkeley. Berkeley has been building, though. They've been, especially UC Berkeley has a couple of new dorm units that take some of the pressure off of the housing stock.
I think the problem is for the working class, like for, I have a lot of restaurant clients separate from real estate. There's, and they tell me how difficult it is to, even if they're offering $20 an hour, to get people dishwashers or even waiters or waitresses and back staff to do the cooking, how difficult it is because they can't afford to live in San Mateo County. And, you know, if they're making $20 an hour, I mean, how are they going to pay even for, even if it's a one bedroom for $1,500, if you could even get a one bedroom for $1,500 a month, that would be more than half their salary. So they have to double up or triple up or quadruple up. And it's making it hard to attract these people. And I've even heard of some restaurants closing because they haven't been able to get back staff.
And of course, that's why the diners have all but disappeared on the peninsula. The bowling alleys have all but disappeared on the peninsula because you can't staff them when it's this tight. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area, where tonight we've been focused on landlord-tenant law. Our guests tonight have been landlord-tenant attorneys extraordinaire Jessica Chalik and Sal Timpano from San Francisco and David Finkelstein of San Mateo. Our final guest has been all of you. So Texas Republicans want to hand the president 5 new House seats. Governor Newsom seeks to counter that vote with redistricting in California. What's all this about? Next week, we will explain what gerrymandering is and why it's a bad thing across the board to some, and others why it's a necessary step. 2 weeks from tonight, we have attorney Roberta Kaplan and author E. Jean Carroll, who says what it's like to stand up to a past and future president despite all his power, even when he says he's not his type. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights next week, every week, Wednesday at 6 o'clock, where as always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to tonight's guests, David Finkelstein, Jessica Chalik, and Sal Timpano, and to all of you for listening. And at the controls, D Minor, I'm Jeff Hayden. Have a good night and zealously guard your legal rights.